So for those of you who are new here, it is sort of the format of an academic paper. And if you don't have a copy of the paper, if you're with a little bubble that can share one and then give a copy of your paper to someone who doesn't have one, that would be great. Anybody back there come in who doesn't have one? There's one there, three, no less. Any extras floating around? Yeah, there's one there.
I can also make copies.
Great, and I can, of course, I can send out some email copies afterwards. So the format is basically I read this thing, and then we have a little break, and then you can start, you know, peppering me with questions. And I suspect some answers will be more intelligent than others. Now, this was originally meant to be delivered to the pastors' conference. But that, of course, was cancelled, and the whole thing was pushed ahead. So this is where we're at. In the meantime, it's also appeared as an article for the Southern Baptist Theological Journal. So if you want a really nice formatted copy, you can get it online from them. Here we go then. Ignore Islam and embrace Ahmed. Modeling the gospel by embracing the culture. God is building his church in the Middle East in ways not seen since the rise of Islam. Even as the historic churches are dying and few Muslims convert directly to Christianity. That's an important sentence right there. Right? These easily verifiable realities seem contradictory, but they are in fact complementary. So the old churches are dying, right? And Muslims are not actually converting. So how then is the church growing? The turmoil in the Middle East has triggered an unprecedented exodus of both Eastern Orthodox and Protestant Christians from the region. When, for example, the U.S. Army finally pulled out of Iraq in 2011, there were 1 million less Christians in that country than when it arrived in 2003. The upheavals which are shaking the region are leading to the fear that nearly 2 millennia of Christianity there will come to an end. And again, in the footnotes there, you'll see a bunch of mainline newspapers, you know, all bemoaning that. At the same time, few Muslims convert directly out of Islam. They first give up on Islam, and then later they seek an alternative. Some of them find Christianity, and these are the ones driving the unprecedented growth of the church in the region today. And so you have, what's taking place today is a shattering of Islam, leading to a crisis of faith among Muslims, leading to a greater openness to Christianity. After the Iranian Revolution of 1979, Islam was hailed as an unstoppable unifying force which would usher in a new era in the wake of failed Arab nationalism. Before that was the era of Arab nationalism. That failed, Islam took its place. Today, however, Islam is shattered and, like a broken car window, it is impossible to see anything hopeful through the fragments, at least from a Muslim perspective. How has a religion, which in the 1980s and 90s gave Muslims a renewed confidence in their distinctive character and in the worth of their civilization and values compared to the West, come to such a low ebb? What are the consequences of this for missions? Islam failed to live up to the high expectations it had fostered. Sharia did not result in God's kingdom on earth. The Muslim Brotherhood's rule over Egypt lasted a mere 13 months, and ISIL failed to redraw the boundaries imposed upon the Middle East by the European colonizers. In 2013, Abdullah Gül, the former Islamist president of Turkey, expressed fears that the ethnic and sectarian conflicts in the Muslim world presaged an era of medieval darkness across the region. Little wonder increasing numbers of disenchanted Middle Easterners are quietly giving up on Islam. The social, economic, and political chaos of today's post-Arab Spring, post-Islamic State, and post-failed coup in Turkey, blamed on an Islamic cleric, have left many a thoughtful Muslim wondering what to believe. Voting patterns bear this out. In the 1995 national elections in Turkey, the strongly religious Welfare Party won 21.3% of the vote. In 2018, its successor, the Felicity Party, won just 1.4% of the vote. Similar stories are repeated across the region. In Egypt, in 2012, the Muslim Brotherhood received over 51% of the vote. But in 2018, a mere 6% had a very positive view of it. In short, large numbers of Middle Easterners today are, at the very least, ambivalent towards Islam. Many are fed up with it. Take Iraq's Kurds, for example. They were once very resistant to the gospel, yet today, a small but growing body of churches is emerging. During a visit in March 2019 to northern Iraq, I asked a number of long-term missionaries how they explained this change. The answers I received were similar. After the 1991 Gulf War, they, the missionaries, were able to enter the region. They learned the language, translated the Bible and other Christian literature, evangelized, launched various mercy ministries, etc. There was some response, but not much. Then, in 2014, the Kurds were suddenly confronted with ISIL. Fighting for their lives, every Kurd had to ask himself, which is true Islam? Their more peaceful version, or that of ISIL? According to those long-term, well-integrated missionaries, about 75% of the Kurds still hold that their version of Islam is the true one. The rest, however, believe that ISIL Salafist, that's like the real fundamentalist version, represents true Islam, and they don't want to have anything to do with it anymore. In other words, a quarter of the Kurdish population is done with Islam. A significant number is turning towards Christianity. Though it is almost impossible to find statistics, it's safe to say that this is true for the rest of the Middle East as well. The Turkish columnist Mustafa Akyol entitled his March 25, 2018 article for the New York Times, How Islamism Drives Muslims to Convert. He estimated that Iranian converts to Christianity from Islam from 1960 to 2010 number around 100,000, and that is a very conservative number. The trend seems strong enough to worry Iran's religious establishment and make it turn to a solution it knows well. Oppression. Garrison, in his 2014 book, A Wind in the House of Islam, corroborates this figure for Muslim background Christians inside Iran. It does not include the many converts in the Iranian diaspora. Like wherever there's an Iranian, community, you'll find an evangelical church there. His book is a tour de force on how God is drawing Muslims around the world to faith in Jesus Christ. One of his conclusions is that, while the tools of jihad and Sharia law have certainly been used to advance Muslim territory, today's Muslims are increasingly repulsed by a religion that imposes its will with force. Muslim brutality against Muslims in North Africa, the Arab world, South Asia, and Indo-Malaysia have been key stimulants to millions of Muslims questioning the divine origins of Islam and turning to Jesus Christ. Muslims do not usually convert directly to Christianity. They first break with Islam, even if secretly, in the heart. Societal pressure and cultural reasons may cause them, when asked, to still self-identify as Muslims, but the religion has lost its hold on them. They will celebrate the annual Feast of Islam with a visit to the mosque and fast for a day or two during Ramadan, much like liberal Christians will celebrate Christmas and Easter. In reality, however, they have become Arabs or Turks or Kurds or North Africans, floundering in an ideological vacuum for a while, and then turning to deism, agnosticism, atheism, or Christianity. Now, the implications of this for Christian outreach is huge. There's at least four things we need to consider. First of all, one, recognize that God uses the nasty affairs of men to draw people to Christ. During his high priestly prayer, Jesus asked God to glorify him because you granted him authority over all people that he might give eternal life to all those you have given him. By the way, if there's a Missio Dei, this is it. This is the Missio Dei. This theological baseline for the Christian missionary enterprise states that the second person of the Trinity has authority over all mankind in order that the atonement he effected will accomplish its purpose. In other words, he will do what it takes to draw his own to himself. He may withdraw common grace or allow war, civil unrest, economic meltdowns, and vast amounts of suffering in order to get a great number of people to question their former worldview and lead them one difficult step at a time to the cross. If ISIL, Al-Qaeda, and all the ethnic and sectarian conflicts across the Middle East lead some to turn their backs on Islam and to become disciples of Christ, then these horrors will have served their purpose. Sovereign grace can lead to gut-wrenching realities. Yet earthly suffering, no matter how bad, pales into insignificance when juxtaposed against eternal realities outside of Christ. This means that missionaries, indeed all Christians, who serve in the context of sovereign grace and who live life in the light of eternity, recognize that as the prophet prophesied, the suffering servant shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. The turmoil engulfing the Muslim world is not meaningless. Christ is using it to build his church. Secondly, do not fear the Muslim world. In the light of this, the Christian need not fear when scanning the internet regarding the Muslim world. There are countless YouTube videos, blogs, podcasts, and articles on jihad, Muslim birth rates, and immigration patterns, suggesting that in X number of years, Muslims will be the majority in this or that Western country. The irrational fear engendered by certain pastors and Christian leaders about the so-called Muslim takeover of the West is largely misplaced. Yes, the Salafist fringe of Islam has historically sought to impose its creed on the rest of the Muslim world. And pockets of these people continue their violent campaigns, usually against fellow Muslims and sometimes against Western targets. Yes, missionaries are at times targeted and do get deported from certain countries on a regular basis. And yes, 6 to 8% of the population who espouse some form of Islamic fundamentalism without resorting to violence is still a large number of people. But if voting patterns are to be believed, the majority of Muslims simply want to live in peace under socially conservative democratic forms of government. Not unlike most evangelical Christians. Most Muslim immigrants and refugees merely want to integrate and make a new life for themselves. And like other waves of immigrants in the past, they will eventually do so. They want to feed their families and educate their children while still maintaining some basic cultural identity markers. And let's not forget that common grace is operative in the Middle East as well. They generally embrace conservative values which are increasingly absent in the current Western context. Islam has a history of progressive thinkers who have sought to integrate Western thought. This began back in the 12th century with Ibn Rushd, Averroes, and through to Rifa'a Tahtawi, Muhammad Abdu, Jamal al-Din al-Afghani, Gamal al-Banna, who's the brother of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. In the 21st century, it continues with writers such as Nasser Hamid Abu Zayd and Irshad Manji. In short, mainstream Islam does not pose some kind of an existential threat to Western culture. By the way, that existential threat comes from within ourselves. Nor to Christianity. Rather, it is seeking to come to terms with it. In any case, Many Middle Easterners today are quietly moving into a post-Islam mentality. Furthermore, many of the clash points between the West and the Middle East are political, not religious in nature. The never-ending Palestinian crisis, for example, is a political, not a religious issue. Even if your eschatology does place it in the theology category, it is an issue best left for God to work out as he sees fit in his own time, and without presumptuous interventions on our part. Our job is to love our neighbor as ourselves. And in his parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus described how to do that in the clearest terms. The great danger of many Christians' misplaced fear of the Muslim world is that it dehumanizes Middle Easterners into a threatening abstraction. It's easy to hate an abstraction. Hating that abstraction is much more difficult if it is embodied by your good friend, Ahmed or Aisha. Point three. So ignore Islam, but embrace the culture. Instead of attacking or undermining a religion which is already under great pressure and which is merely experienced by most Middle Easterners as part of their cultural heritage, we must learn to love and relate to them at a personal and cultural level. The region is very diverse. Egyptians, Tunisians, Turks, Syrians, Palestinians, Kurds, Moroccans, each one of the dozens of ethnic groups has its own history, language, and ways of looking at the world. Yet few of those who seek to, quote unquote, reach the Muslim world appear to display any significant knowledge or appreciation of its rich literature, heart-rending music, excellent cinematography, wonderful cuisine, and extreme diversity of social and political thought. Few Christians have deep, genuine friendships with Middle Easterners as a basis from which to communicate our deeply relational gospel message. All it takes is a couple of good friends, an Ahmed or an Aisha, to introduce you to their wonderfully rich world. Incarnational ministry is the ability to experience the world the way others do, and to model the Christian faith in ways they can hope to imitate. It means becoming bicultural, and this takes time and effort. It's relatively easy to learn all about Islam or a particular country or tribe without ever learning how to relate, befriend, love, appreciate. It involves sensitivity, patience, and a commitment to their culture and language with the goal of identification and empathy, not mere objective knowledge and understanding. These things cannot be learned from a book. You grow into them through time-consuming, persevering, sacrificial friendships. It means finding people with whom you have a common interest by, for instance, joining a club, a sports team, or a cooking class. It means allowing some of your social needs to be met by them. Middle Easterners live in extended families. Once you've been invited into their world, you'll meet more people than you can cope with. It means trying to learn a little of their language. It means learning to appreciate their understanding of the past by reading their historians. It means reading their popular novels that have been translated into English. Writers like Najib Mahfouz, Nobel Prize winner, Yashar Kemal, Ala al-Aswani. If you want to read a great book, read the Yacoubian Building. Amin Malouf, Elif Shafak, dozens of others. They can humanize the Middle East to you like no one else can. A good writer from a particular culture can really humanize, help you make sense of that world. It means redefining your sense of personal space. Becoming comfortable with someone of the same sex holding your hands. It means becoming more people than task-orientated. Hospitality is a hugely important part of Middle Eastern culture. Have you ever noticed how much of Jesus' ministry was centered around meals? You may have to alter your lifestyle. Supper may be served much later, and visitors can easily stay till midnight. Now, we'd have prayer meeting at our place, It wouldn't start till 9 o'clock, and it wouldn't end till midnight. You may have to get rid of offensive pets like dogs. We have these missionaries, you know. And how come all these people are visiting your place and nobody else visits us? Well, get rid of this stupid wiener dog that licks people's feet when they cross the threshold. Right? Oh, but the kids love the dog. It often means confining your relationships to your own sex, man to man and woman to woman, and altering your demeanor accordingly. You can be more effusive, warm, and affectionate with the same sex. But with the opposite sex, you need to be cooler, speak more softly, and in more conservative societies, avoid eye contact. You may find that when couples visit you, they're more comfortable with men in one corner and women in another corner, with little cross-talking. Most Middle Eastern men love to talk about politics, soccer, and religion, though politics is a minefield best avoided. Popular subjects among women include food, clothes, raising children. It means letting them define modestly, not our culture. This means knowing what is considered decent and going one step further. It means embracing and affirming those aspects of their culture which are positive, particularly such biblically supported items as honoring parents, hospitality, strict regulation of sexual behavior, giving to the poor, fasting, loyalty, a ban on drunkenness, etc. As Christians, the way we relate within our family is potentially our greatest testimony. Do we love and respect our spouses? Do we have gender-specific roles in our marriage? Do we exercise loving, consistent discipline of our children? Will we do everything in our power to protect our daughter's virginity? Do we ever appear to be alone with a member of the opposite sex who is not a relative? Avoid every appearance of evil, says the Apostle Paul. And he says, we put no stumbling block in anyone's path so that our ministry will not be discredited. The point is that embracing Middle Easterners begins with establishing deep relationships. This requires evaluating which aspects of our life and behavior are merely Western baggage, which may need to be sacrificed, and which aspects of their culture we can adopt without compromising the essentials of the Christian faith. Can we say, I have become all things to all men that I might save some? And then fourthly, don't argue, but share and model your faith in a culturally relevant way. Long intellectual arguments rarely lead anywhere. God is, in any case, in the process of discrediting Islam. There's no need for us to shoulder that task. At the same time, we must reject that which is contrary to basic Christianity, such as belief in Muhammad as a prophet, maintaining honor at any price, fatalistic practices, the conceptual reduction of Jesus as less than the second person of the triune God, anything less than penal substitutionary atonement, etc. Jesus' storytelling, anecdotal approach is much more suitable for the Middle East than Paul's use of linear logic. A New Testament story which Jesus told may be over-familiar to us, but can be shocking and very effective when a Muslim hears it for the first time. With a bit of sanctified imagination, it's quite easy to deal with the standard questions Muslims have about Christianity by using parables and stories. If you want me to model that, I can do that afterwards. And surely, we can learn to communicate the major tenets of our faith by means of culturally relevant illustrations. Middle Easterners can appreciate those who know what they believe and who can articulate it boldly and clearly. It's a religion of power. And if you come across strong, knowing what you believe, able to push back intelligently, that's respected. The skill of rhetoric is greatly admired. We can also share what it means for us as Christians to know God and to experience Him in daily life. We must demonstrate that our faith works for us even in suffering. As we model Christ-likeness and learn to give a reasonable account for the hope that is within us, we will, in time, be recognized by some as godly people with a faith they want to emulate. My wife used to meet with a bunch of women in our apartment building every 6 weeks or so, the same set of women. Every 6 weeks, they would meet. About 12 of them, 10 or 12, I can't remember. And one day the conversation came around to who were the godly people in our apartment. Well, there was an imam who lived there, and of course his wife had to be godly. And the other godly person recognized in our apartment was Anna, our wife. They was a consensus, they were the two godly women in our apartment. Just by modeling. a faith they want to emulate. The 4 points above relate more to our personal outreach to Middle Easterners. There is, however, another important implication for missionary outreach to the region itself. And this is important for those engaged in missions. Shift from supporting traditional Orthodox background Protestant churches to Muslim background believers. This is a sensitive subject. There are Protestant evangelical churches in such countries as Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, Turkey, Iran, as well as further afield, like Pakistan and Indonesia. Some of these churches are large and sophisticated, such as the Presbyterian Church of Qasr Dubara in Cairo, with some 6,000 worshippers each week. It's quite an experience, by the way, to worship in that church. 6,000, you know, Arabs all singing, praising the Lord, the PowerPoint, the band, right in Tahrir Square there, in Cairo, the heart of Cairo. But very few in these congregations come out of a Muslim background. The history of these Protestant denominations goes back to a conference held in Malta in 1828, in which the missionary community made a strategic decision to target the existing ethnically Christian minority populations, Eastern Orthodox, Armenian, Coptics, etc., to the exclusion of the Muslim majority. In other words, they made a strategic decision. Instead of reaching Muslims directly, we're going to reach these Orthodox churches, right? See if we can revive them, and then they, in turn, will become a testimony to the Muslim world. They ended up splitting these ancient churches and establishing their own evangelical denominations, which continue to exist. These denominations have their own parachurch organizations, seminaries, and other ministries. These churches are, by and large, afraid of inviting Muslims into their midst. Although there are wonderful individual exceptions, the idea of actively reaching out to, discipling, and integrating Muslim background believers into their churches is generally not on their conceptual horizon. The fear of a backlash from society, of having the government shut down their churches and seminaries, or, on a personal level, of having a Muslim convert fall in love with one of their daughters, keeps them from engaging meaningfully with the majority culture. Yet most missionary resources of personnel, money, and expertise are channeled towards these churches and their ministries. In many cases, they would cease to exist without them. However, they rarely touch the majority population, something borne out by 2 centuries of missionary cooperation with them. They can be a distraction to those seeking to reach the majority culture, and we must disentangle ourselves from them. We cannot expect Muslim background believers to thrive when they are relegated to the margins of a fearful subculture. As already noted, traditional Christianity is, in any case, declining precipitously across the region. This means that the new generation of missionaries must learn to reach Muslims directly, even if at the expense and often over the protests of the rump of the existing Orthodox background Protestant church. A similar dynamic took place in the waning years of the Ottoman Empire. The ancient Orthodox churches and the evangelical ones torn from them absorbed virtually all the missionary resources, yet they failed to reach out in any significant way to the Muslim majority population. Then, in 1915, the Armenian massacres led to the virtual elimination of Christianity from Asia Minor. When, half a century later, missionaries showed up again in what had become the Republic of Turkey, they had no option other than to work with Muslims. Today, for the first time in history, a small but significant Muslim background, ethnically Turkish church is growing and maturing in the region. And that's where we spent most of our missionary career. The most recent wars in Iraq and Syria and the civil unrest elsewhere have resulted in many ethnically Christian minorities fleeing to the West. While we lament the suffering involved in their displacement, might God be orchestrating these events to allow us to refocus our efforts on the remaining majority populations? to conclude. It's easy to critique and debunk Islam. It's much more difficult to develop genuine, sensitive, and caring relationships with Middle Easterners, for that involves looking critically at our own cultural offensiveness, yet without removing the offense of the cross. God is at work in the Middle East, discrediting Islam in macro ways. We don't need to do that for him. He's also forcing mission strategists to rethink our approach to the region. Each one of us, however, can embrace the privilege of communicating the glorious alternative of God's grace in Jesus Christ to our friends Ahmed and Aisha.